Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the African American Studies Program at Boston University. Speaking will be visiting scholar Harcourt Fuller. Mr. Fuller's lecture is titled Slavery and Abolition in Peru. We begin with an introduction by Professor Linda Haywood, Director of Boston University's African American Studies Program.
Mr. Fuller is a visiting scholar in the African American Studies program here at Boston University. He is currently at work, among other things, on his doctoral dissertation entitled Building the Nation, Symbolic Nationalism During the Kwame Nkrumah Era in the Gold Coast, Ghana, for the International History Department at the London School of Economics. This project is a part of Mr. Fuller's ongoing research into the Gold Coast, on which he has also written his master's thesis. Mr. Fuller has worked as a research assistant in the Department of Coins and Metals for British Museum, where he conducted research on the history of indigenous and modern monies in Africa from antiquity to the present, and where he co-edited a book, Money in Africa, a peer-reviewed book of the collected papers from the Money in Africa Conference held at the British Museum last spring. He also served as the co-chair of the Association for the Study of Ethnicity and Nationalism, for which he organized the ASEN Seminar Series and Memorial Lectures. Although Mr. Fuller is quite a young scholar, he has a really impressive research and publication. His work has appeared in the journals Barter News and Glimpses. He has presented papers at the British Museum, New York University, and the Schomburg Library, as well as the University of the West Indies and the Department of Black and Hispanic Studies, Baruch College of the City of New York. His research has won him many grants, including the University of London Central Research Fund grant and the Morris Pinto PhD scholarship from the London School of Economics. Mr. Fuller will be giving us a lecture on slavery and abolition in Peru. Mr. Fuller.
Thank you, Professor Haywood. Before I go into my presentation today, I also needed to acknowledge funding that I've received for over 10 years working on the African diaspora in what I call the Pacific littoral of Ecuador, Peru, and Colombia. And I also wanted to say briefly about how I became interested in researching the African diaspora in that part of South America. When I was an undergrad at City College of New York, I went on a study abroad program to Ecuador. That was about 1998. But I went to study something as an international student of international studies that was completely different from the African diaspora in Ecuador. I was looking at how the indigenous populations of the Amazon region utilize their history, culture, and their natural resources to attain sustainable development. After being in Quito for about 3 months and going to the university where I was studying, I hadn't seen any people of African descent. But one day I was going to school and I saw a young man shining someone's shoes, and the young man looked black. So obviously I was quite surprised. And I went over to the young man and I said in Spanish, "Eres negro? Are you black?" And he looked at me surprisingly and said, "Claro que sí. Of course I'm black." So I sort of was so excited because, you know, normally in the textbooks on Peru, you really don't find that there are peoples of African ancestry. You know, they talk mainly about the various indigenous ethnic groups. And so I started to ask the young man questions about where he was from, et cetera, and he told me that there's a whole village about 6 hours by bus from Quito, where you can find black people. And matter of fact, he said, if you want to go there, you know, I'll write a letter to my father and they'll accept you. So the next week, I set off on a bus ride, 6 hours in the Andes Mountain in Quito, and I went to El Valle del Chota, which is a predominantly black settlement. And as soon as I got off the bus, there were literally maybe about 100 people there to greet me. And it was one of the most exciting experiences I ever had. So subsequently, I emailed my advisor at City College when I got back to New York, and I said, I want to change my thesis topic. And this was halfway through my thesis. So that's just how that started. So what I'd like to do today is to look at the institution of slavery in Peru. And my lecture is going to be divided mainly into two parts. I'm going to look at rural slavery by examining the hacienda system. I'm looking specifically at one of the most important haciendas, which was the Hacienda San Jose. I'd also like to explore the life of blacks in the urban setting, looking at black slaves and freed people in Lima. But before I do that, I just wanted to read a bit and sort of talk a bit about the wider African diaspora in Latin America, and then look specifically but briefly at the African diaspora in Ecuador, Peru, and Colombia, which is the topic of my research and also the topic. I'm actually writing up two books about that topic. The scholarship on the Atlantic slave trade, that is, the history of the multitude of Africans who were taken from the continent of Africa since the early 1500s and who settled in the New World, is well known. Philip Curtin, 1969, in his book, and others after him have adequately documented the dynamics of the trade, especially on the west coast of Africa and the eastern coast of the Americas, or in the Americas in general. Philip's findings highlight the numbers of Africans transported to the Americas, their places of origin in the Old World, and the people involved in the transactions of the slave merchandise. Although there is wide variation on the actual numbers involved, Curtin estimates that at least 12 to 15 million Africans were shipped to the other side of the Atlantic. Of that figure, 43% were shipped to the Caribbean and the Guyanas, and only 4.5% to North America, mainly the United States. Brazil, of course, received the bulk of the shipment. Today, for example, Brazil is said to have the largest black population outside of Africa, only second to Nigeria, having a population of people of African descent numbering, depending on the scholar that you examine, 45 to 75 million people. And the reason for that variation, which is also relevant to Peru, is how people identify themselves and how the government or how researchers choose to identify people. However, the history and contemporary realities of peoples of African origin in Spanish America, especially in the Pacific littoral and Andean regions of South America, has been largely neglected. So basically, the area that I study is one of my colleagues, Juan Garcia Salazar, who is an Afro-Ecuadorian, refers to as La Gran Colombia. This is the area of El Chocó, which is the forested region on the Pacific coast of Colombia, largely inhabited by blacks. Somewhere between 75 to 95% of this area is inhabited by peoples of African descent. And that also borders this area of Ecuador, which is called Esmeraldas, also a predominantly black area. And then also, as I mentioned, in Quito, there are communities of blacks in the Andean region. In Peru, the majority of blacks, historically during the period of slavery and also today, live in Lima. Today, about 73% of the black population lives in Lima. But also in the Departamento de Ica, as you go toward Chile, you also have a very important black population, which I'll talk about. But also further up north in Puira, Lambayeque, Trujillo, you have black population. So this is the sort of the spread of the black population. In Peru, I worked in Lima and Ica. And in Ecuador, I worked in Quito and Esmeraldas, and also with the border communities there. In the province of Cañete, which is in the Departamento de Ica, this is where you find the majority of blacks in a town called Chincha. And also in Chincha, in another sort of village called El Carmen, you find the Hacienda San Jose. So, as I said, in Ecuador, you find blacks in Esmeraldas on the Pacific coast and also in Quito. In Colombia, you find them, you know, throughout the country, but predominantly in El Chocó. And in Peru, you find them in Lima, in Chincha, and elsewhere. Let me look at rural slavery at this point. Communities of peoples of African ancestry are found along the length and breadth of the arid Peruvian coast. Estimates of the percentage of blacks in Peru range from 2% to 10%, government figures tending to be far more conservative than that of unofficial sources. 2007 statistics put the Peruvian population at roughly 28 million people. The statistics also recognize several ethnic groups: Amerindian, 45%, Mestizo, meaning of mixed Amerindian and white, 37%, and whites, blancos, 15%. Blacks, Japanese, Chinese, and other minorities comprise 3% of the population, and again, that's the official estimates. The percentage of blacks in Peru is always an issue of debate, since many people who are of African ancestry do not consider themselves as such. In addition, many rural areas and urban slums where Afro-Peruvians abide are not properly represented in the statistics. Given these factors, some analysts put the Afro-Peruvian population between 6 to 10%. Of the total population. And this is important because during the colonial period, during the period of slavery, and even after the abolition of slavery, there were a variety of different names for people of African ancestry. Quinterón, Cuarterón, if you were one-fourth white, one-fifth white, you know, a variety. So it's always difficult to decide exactly what the percentage of the black population is. Unlike other slave-receiving societies in the New World, the arrival of blacks or of Africans to Peru took place under two distinct circumstances. In the first case, black slaves known as Ladinos, with a D, Ladinos, who were Africans that were first taken to Spain to be Hispanized and Christianized, were brought as a part of the invading forces of Francisco Pizarro in 1527. These Hispanized black soldiers made their initial entry into Peru by way of Tumbes, today the northern border of Peru with Ecuador. And normally the slaves came through Cartagena de Indias, which is the border town between Panama and Colombia, and then they came further, you know, down. Secondly, after the Spanish had established their stronghold in Peru, African slaves were brought in to replace the indigenous labor force that had been worn down by the harsh task delegated by the Spanish. Most of the slaves that made it to Peru were brought from British, Dutch, and Portuguese traders after they were transshipped from the Caribbean and Central America. For the most part, the slaves originated from what are today the countries of Angola, Congo, and Mozambique. Since the colonial period, the majority of blacks have resided principally in Lima, as I mentioned. It is interesting to note that the number of blacks in the capital of Lima were so many that they came to outnumber other ethnic groups, including the Spanish, for most of the 17th century. Since the arrival of these slaves to Peru, their forced labor was centered on plantations or haciendas in rural areas, such as the Hacienda San Jose in El Carmen. They were also in the service of the rich aristocracy and merchant classes in Lima. In the War of Independence, General San Martin, protector of Peru, offered liberty to all blacks who would join his army to fight for secession from the yoke of Spanish rule. However, after independence was won on the 28th of July, 1821, San Martin rescinded his promise and did not liberate the blacks. He did not liberate the soldiers and slaves who fought for independence. Instead, he declared the liberty of the womb, which was also the case in many other slaveholding societies. And what that means is that the liberty of the womb means that former slaveholders had the right to be guardians of newborn male blacks up to the age of 24 and female blacks until age 20. The age limit was always further extended. For example, it was extended to age 50 in 1839. However, slavery continued in the New Republic until the 5th of December, 1854, when the revolutionary military president Ramon Castilla finally ordered the manumission of slaves in Peru. The following verses were written by Nicomedes Santa Cruz. I will read a verse from lyrics from a song. Nicomedes Santa Cruz is Peru's most famous or most notable decimero. Decimero is a sort of like a spoken word artist, but he's also an ethnomusicologist and sort of a historian. And the song is a testimony of the experiences of slaves taken from Africa to coastal Peru, and it attests to the uniqueness of Peruvian culture and identity. So the song, the lyrics go, "Rhythms of slavery, against bitterness and pain, to the beat of the chains, black rhythms of Peru. My grandmother came from Africa, adorned in shells. Spaniards bought her in a caravel ship. They marked her with fire. The branding iron was her cross. And in South America, between blows of pain, they gave blacks drums, rhythms of slavery. For a single coin, they were sold in Lima, and in La Molina Hacienda, she served the Spanish. She and other blacks from Angola earned so much for their work, mosquitoes to suck their blood, hard ground to sleep upon, and nothing to console against bitterness and pain. On the sugar plantation, the sad socavón was born, and at the rum press, black people sang the zana. The machete cut at brown hands, and Indians with flutes and blacks with timbrels sang unhappy fortunes to the beat of the chains. The old died, but in the cane fields the sound of samacueca could be heard and the panalivio far in the distance. And one hears the courting songs my mother sang in her youth, from Cañete to Timbuktu, from Chancay to Mozambique. Clear notes carry black rhythms of Peru." You know, in my research, I use a lot of music because Afro-Peruvians have really been the artists, and you know, they've really used music and dance as a way of documenting their history. In the rural area, the most important hacienda involved in the slave trade was the Hacienda San Jose in El Carmen. The earliest news of the Hacienda San Jose goes back to 1688, when Rosa Muñatones married Don Andres de Salazar, bringing as her dowry the Casa Hacienda, country house, with the chapel and cropland located in the valley of Chincha. Initially, San Jose was turned into a sugar plantation with 87 black slaves producing sugar and honey, two of the most prized products at the time. In 1764, a marriage alliance between Rosa Salazar and Don Fernando Carrillo de Albornoz y Bravo Lagunas provided for the expansion of San Jose with the purchasing of the neighboring Hacienda San Reyes from the Jesuits. That's a picture of the Hacienda San Reyes. Unfortunately, today in Chincha, there's not much left of some of these haciendas, but you know the buildings. Some of the buildings still stand, and you know it's quite interesting to look at. You know, one of you know to look at how they were used during the slave period. Together, San Jose and San Reyes formed one of the richest properties in Chincha. Almost 1,000 slaves worked in the sugar and cotton industry. So now you have this expanded Hacienda San Jose, which is basically an hacienda joined by the marriage of two powerful families. If you go to Peru today and you go to the Hacienda San Jose, you'll find this painting hanging on the veranda of the hacienda. And it was painted in 1834 by a slave. This painting, as I said, it was done in 1834 by a slave who painted it in honor of his master and owner of the hacienda. Depicted in the painting are the activities of the slaves, including a slave girl dancing in a ring of other slaves to the right, a cockfight sort of like in the middle, and what appears to be new recruits in the military, and also what appears to be a slave auction. And the archives at the Hacienda substantiate this. You can also see the great house to the rear, the church to the left, or the chapel, and the residential quarters, which also house the slave quarters, which I'll show you, to the right. During the period of slavery, you know, close to where the Hacienda is a small village called El Carmen. And this was a place where slaves, you know, older slaves or slaves that were sort of injured in the line of work, they would, and also slaves that wanted to escape, you know, the haciendas, they would run away to El Carmen, and it sort of became a maroon town. Hence, in the midst of slavery, El Carmen provided a safe haven or palenque for maroons, runaway slaves, and others to escape slavery. This is what El Carmen looks like today. It's very arid, like most of the Peruvian coast. And again, you know, if you go to Peru and you really want to see evidence of sort of the legacy of the African traditions, this is the place to go. The song, dance, the oral traditions. And these are some of the folks that I interviewed for the book. Let me now talk about the abolition or the manumission of slavery and sort of what that how that affected blacks. On 5th December 1854, Ramon Castilla ordered the manumission of the slaves in Peru. His government paid on average 300 pesos de oro to emancipate each slave. Now we need to think about this vast sum of money that the slave owners received in order to free their slaves, and what that meant for the, you know, for the economy. For other slaves, the amount was even higher, especially for females used for breeding purposes. The price of their liberation was up to 600 pesos de oro. So women used for breeding purposes, you know, their value was twice that of ordinary slaves. The amount was equivalent to about one-third of the cost of a half an acre of land planted with sugarcane in the case of male slaves and two-thirds in the case of female slaves used in the production of the slave stock. The state paid slave owners half the cost of each in cash and the other half in debt bonds. The Castilla government was able to assume this huge public debt through the exploitation of guano, which was a rich fertilizer formed from centuries of accumulated bird droppings in chincha, and which they found during the 1840s and 1850s. Despite the decreed manumission of slaves, many owners of the haciendas, particularly those in chincha, denied blacks their freedom and forced them to continue working on the plantations as before. This and other factors contribute to several rebellions against slave owners, the most notorious of which occurred at the height of the Chilean invasion of Peru, that is, during the Pacific War. On 25th December 1879, the blacks on the plantation gave the proprietors a Christmas gift to die for. At the age of 25, Julio Carrillo de Albornoz, the last heir of the Carrillo family, was murdered by slaves on the main steps of the Casa Hacienda San Jose. After burning the cane fields of the hacienda, the rebel blacks advanced to the neighboring plantations, demolishing property and taking their vengeance out on anyone who tried to defend the owners, if not on the latter themselves. The rebellion was only squashed by army reinforcements from Chincha Alta only a few days after it had been initiated. As previously stated, in the rural areas in the province of Chincha and in neighboring Cañete, the creation of the Republic of Peru in 1821 and the end of slavery over 30 years later in 1854 did not alter the lives of Afro-Peruvians in any significant way. Instead, blacks continued living like slaves and remained the lowest citizens on the social scale. Black men and women continued performing services for their former white slave owners, such as being nannies, cooks, farm workers, ironsmiths, bodyguards, and the like. And I would even argue that even today, that's how, you know, the majority of blacks live. You don't find blacks, for example, in high political office, in the military, etc. After 1854, when the state renounced its legal practice of slavery and paid the slave owners for surrendering their human merchandise, blacks found themselves in uncompromising predicaments. They were given liberty without preparation or the means to survive on their own. Furthermore, the Carrillos and other wealthy landowners in Chincha and elsewhere found themselves with an excess of cash, but no slaves to labor on their properties. They evicted blacks from their haciendas and deprived them of food, shelter, and other essentials that were formerly provided for slaves. Many blacks were left with no other alternative than to return to the hacendados for slave-like wages or to create independent communities in rural areas. Others had to find creative means of existing on their own in a hostile society in which, again, they were at the bottom of the social hierarchy. Many resorted to delinquency as a strategy of survival. Other ex-slaves who had been skilled laborers went on to become artisans, carpenters, bricklayers, masons, etc. The stronger males in the Chincha Cañete Valley dispersed to the port of Tambo de Mora to look for work as dock workers and load carriers, transporting merchandise for the import-export market. Let me also add that, you know, after the manumission of slavery, there was a large sort of wave of immigration from Europe. Chinese coolies were also imported to substitute for the, you know, the lost labor, and also a lot of the indigenous population from the Sierra, from the Andes region, migrated to coastal Peru to take advantage of new opportunities. And that would signal a decrease, when taken into account, when other factors are taken into account, that signaled a decrease in the population of blacks over time. In 1972, the military regime of Juan Velasco Alvarado instituted the Reforma Agraria, or the agrarian reform, in Ica, in Chincha, which overturned the existing economic order based on the monopolistic ownership of lands by the hacienda owners. Under the reforma, the hacienda system was broken up and the lands were taken from the hacendados and handed over to agricultural cooperatives. The cooperatives, in turn, were dissolved in 1985 to give way to parcelación, or land division, in which former members of the cooperatives each received several acres of land. Although the lands were beneficial to some farmers, others did not have the means to farm their own lands, and in many cases, they had to sell those lands back to the hacendados, thereby maintaining the previously existing economic status quo. You know, one of the interesting things when we look at the legacy of slavery in Peru, one of the things that struck me was that today, the people who live, black people who live in El Carmen, basically still perform the same jobs or the same functions that they did during the period of slavery. They work for the Hacienda San Jose as nannies, handymen, collecting garbage, disposing of garbage. And, the Hacienda San Jose is the main employer in El Carmen, even today. So that just shows how, although slavery was abolished, but the relationship between the haves and the have not changed. I'd like to end there and basically open it up for discussion.
Okay, well, thank you so very much, Mr. Fuller. Very.
Thank you.
And we now have questions. Yes, we have.
Yes.
I found your presentation very fascinating. I'm just curious, in terms of the present day, is there any kind of a conscious black pride movement or a political kind of organization that's taking place?
Thanks for the question. I'm working on a chapter. Again, I've been looking at Peru and Colombia for about 10 years, and I really haven't, I expect to put out a book in the next 2 years, but I'm working on a chapter looking at the sort of civil rights movement that, that has happened in Peru since the Second World War, when they were looking at the American model, for example, and also the African independence movement. There was a civil rights movement in Peru which galvanized in the 1980s. Students at the universities formed several organizations. Today you will find the Movimiento Negro Francisco Congo, the Francisco Congo Black Movement, and also the Peruvian, the Black Human Rights Association in Peru. Those are two political organizations that are always protesting. For example, even today, or at least 10 years ago when I was in Peru, if you're black, you can't. There are certain clubs in certain neighborhoods that if you're black, you cannot enter. If you're indigenous, you cannot enter. It's only for whites. And that came out in the newspaper. So they're always protesting whenever racism occurs, and they also publish a magazine exploring the history of blacks in Peru and also addressing issues of racism. And also what they do, which is quite commendable, is that they go into school systems and they put on programs to educate other Peruvians about black history and also about the contemporary situations that they face. So yes, there is a political movement.
And take the opportunity to ask a question. Now, since the numerical significance of the of blacks or people of African descent is sort of watered down because of the various ways of, you know, government listing and people's self-identification, to what extent would such a sort of black consciousness movement contradict the assimilationist pattern, let's say, of a Peruvian, you know, government? Because looking back in this 18th century Peru, some visuals that I've seen sort of suggest that even at that time there was, in fact, very much a, you know, I've seen some of the people of African descent dressed in Spanish clothes, but also dressed as native, you know, in the, you know, indigenous clothing, and I've seen depictions of certain dances that are more indigenous. So what I'm suggesting that is that there was, in fact, over the years, much more of a tendency to integrate into a sort of general Peruvian culture than the what you're suggesting now, to kind of a separate. And since the group is so small, what do you think is the significance of this Black Consciousness Movement?
Well, let me say that I think the answer is twofold. On the one hand, Peru during the colonial period was in fact characterized by, for lack of a better word, race mixing, miscegenation. It was profound, actually. That's on the one hand. But on the other hand, you did have a very strong sort of African identity, which was found in, for example, various brotherhoods, various religious brotherhoods that were syncretized into Christianity. So you had both existing at the same time. And as I said before, that for the majority of the 17th century, blacks were the majority ethnic group in Lima. But over time, through a variety of events, you know, the participation of blacks in the various wars between different caudillos, you know, you had you had a high death rate, you had a low birth rate, and also because of, you know, after 1854-55, when manumission occurred, you had European immigrants coming in, you had Serranos moving to the coast, and you had a lot of mixing. But and so a lot of the cultural aspects of black history were appropriated, for example, by other groups. So whereas initially it was identified with, you know, with black culture, by the 1860s and onward, those, you know, certain songs, dances, for example, the cuisine was attributed to maybe indigenous Peruvians or maybe the mestizos. So it's kind of difficult to say the extent to which, you know, having a specific black identity was important, because you have both things happening at the same time. But what significantly I think revived a sense of black pride or black identity was in the post-Second World War period, where you had musicians like Nicome de Santa Cruz, groups like Peru Negro, who went back and they tried to rediscover their ancestry. And when you look at the advent of television and radio in, for example, the 60s, black music started getting played on radio. Programs, you know, began to be put on TV. People started to go out, and black people started to rediscover themselves. They also looked to the United States Civil Rights Movement and the Independence Movement in Africa, and there was a renewed sense of identity that has carried on since that time. So that's why today you find blacks sort of identifying and accepting, you know, their heritage, although it's problematic.
What are some of the issues of identity?
Well, class. Okay. You do have a small minority of the elites, I mean, a small minority of blacks who own land, or a few who are teachers, a few who are somehow moneyed. the entertainers, the singers, for example, the sports, the football, soccer figures. And to a certain degree, what the sense that I got, and also from the literature, you sort of have two classes, you know, that class of blacks and the regular blacks who somehow feel disconnected from those blacks. So what the some of the political organizations try to do is that they try to bridge that gap. They go around to different schools, to the communities, and they try to get black people together to talk about issues of identity. And, you know, they have the same issues with identity that other black communities have of self-loathing, I would say, for example. You know, they know they're black, but somehow they internalize some of the negative attributes of blackness that have been, you know, there since slavery. And so one of the main tasks of these political organizations is to reestablish a sense of pride in their heritage.
Thanks for an excellent talk. You mentioned about the Afro-Peruvians have maintained some of their the music and culture from a few centuries. Is there any remnant of African languages like Gullah is like in North Carolina? Are there any African? Is there African patois or? Another question is, could you talk about the relationship between the Afro-Peruvians and other minority groups? I noticed when you mentioned the 3%, you lumped also Japanese and Chinese. What are the relationships between these groups? I know the Japanese Peruvians have been very powerful there.
Okay, so the first question again was about the remnants. There's a great book. I can't remember the title at the moment, but the answer to your question is yes. The Peruvian blacks, they speak Spanish, but they also speak, I mean, depending on where you go, you know, in Lima they speak a distinct kind of Spanish. But when you go down to Chincha in the rural areas, they do have words that come from, I guess, Angola, Mozambique, those places. And there is a book, I think it's the title is something like Kimba Malambe Fe, Africanisms in Afro-Peruvian Dialect. So there is a book specifically dealing with that. But just kind of jumping to the other country, if you go to El Chocó in Colombia, you'll find a more preserved remnants of African words in that Spanish. But it's not, I wouldn't say that it's very prevalent in Peru, but you do have words. With regard to your second question, you know, after 1854-55, when slavery was abolished, and as I said, you know, you had an influx of a variety of different groups, Chinese indentured servants who came in, and also the indigenous populations came in from the Andes region to take advantage of a variety of things. I would characterize the relationship among these groups as sort of tense, because blacks found themselves in a situation where they were no longer property, but they were being substituted by other groups who were sort of taking their jobs. So there was always this, you know, fighting between the different groups, although, you know, they did work together on many occasions. But, for example, after manumission, I had mentioned that during the Pacific War there was a slave rebellion on the Hacienda San Jose. Many Chinese people were killed by the slaves because, you know, they sort of saw the Chinese as siding with, you know, with the landed classes, siding with the government. So whenever there was sort of like an uprising, as in the case of the uprising at the Hacienda, they among the first people that would be killed would be the Chinese, for example. And so, you know, the relationship is sort of both good and bad at the same time.
What about the indigenous population? Do they have better relations with the indigenous population today, or in the past?
Well, with the indigenous population, I mean, there is a lot of mixing. There's a lot of, you know, if you, there's a group, sort of like an ethnic name called, I guess they call them Sambos or Sambos de Mulato, which is a mixture of indigenous peoples and Africans. So they do mix, especially in the rural areas, they do mix. But I find more competition in the urban settings where you have differences. And I think that in the contemporary sense, one of the reasons why you find tensions between the indigenous population and the black population is that a lot of the government assistance, a lot of international aid, goes to the indigenous population because they are the ones who are recognized as sort of the authentic Peruvians, the ones who have been marginalized by history. And a lot, for the most part, blacks are left out of it. So you find blacks trying to compete with the indigenous populations for government grants to better their communities or for international aid and for jobs. They're always complaining that, you know, the world only sees the indigenous Peruvians and they don't recognize blacks. And that's one of the reasons why the intellectuals have tried to sort of, address these issues and to make blacks more transparent.
Well, I'm actually I focus in Latin America for my studies, so I'm actually very interested, so thank you for this lecture.
Thank you.
You mentioned that in the rural sectors, things haven't really changed too much. So I was just wondering how it is now in the urban sectors. Because you talked about how it was like in the past and how they were soldiers, but I was just wondering how it was today.
In terms of what?
Yeah, if anything's changed or if it's similar to them going into the army or something.
Well, I mean, what I found was in Lima, for example, the majority of blacks live in certain ghettos, basically. You don't find blacks living in Miraflores in certain prominent neighborhoods. They really live in the, you know, sort of like in El Callao in the outskirts, and they live in the ghetto areas. But so what do they normally do? The women are normally nannies or cooks for the wealthy. The men, when I went to Peru, one of the first black person that I saw, he was wiping the windshield of a car. They are pallbearers at funerals, doormen at hotels. A few art teachers, only a few of them. There are no black, as far as I know, there are no black politicians in Lima. There was one black mayor in Chincha, which is in the rural area. So you find that they're still sort of trapped in these kinds of positions. They haven't really advanced to the level that blacks in the United States or elsewhere have advanced. And that's always, you find that throughout Latin America, that the army and also the police force is sort of a means of achieving upward mobility. But you do find blacks in the army, but not as officers.
I'm curious about the influence in music. For, I guess over 20 years, I've been aware of Peruvian music, and some of it I've found very appealing, but I wasn't aware that there was any black population in Peru until about, I guess, 15 years ago. There was a major exhibition in D.C., a Folklife Festival, where they brought representatives of the black diaspora from all over South America and Central America.
Susana Baca was there.
Because I was especially struck by one exhibit. It just took me back home to Alabama.
Yeah.
You know, the dirt front yard, mm-hmm. someone walking around sweeping.
Yeah.
You know, when we did it, it was to make sure the snakes weren't out there. And cooking out on the ground. All, mm-hmm. They just looked like people from my home. So I knew there were black people then, but I still had never made any connection with music. And I'm just curious, the most popular music, does it have any African influence, or what's called indigenous Peruvian music? Is that more likely something from the Andes? And what about instrumentation? Are the instruments, is there any influence like the influence of the banjo, for mm-hmm. example, on popular American music?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is that, so, you know, obviously in Peru they do have international rock and all these things, but I would say that if you didn't know that there were blacks in Peru, you would think that Peruvian, let me rephrase that. Peruvian popular music as it stands today is black music, but it's not marketed as such. Since the 60s, when you had these great musicians and ethnomusicologists and activists who popularized music, it's like jazz in a way, you know, it ceases to be black, right? So that's the same thing that happened to that's the same thing that happened to Afro-Peruvian music. When you are in Peru, the artists that you'll see, you know, singing popular music are black, but if you listen to it on the radio or in the way how it's not packaged as Afro-Peruvian music. It's packaged as Peruvian popular music. That's how it's packaged today.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Ms. Fuller, for a wonderful session. We really enjoyed, you know, the splendid presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is WBUR. You've been listening to a lecture presented by the African American Studies Program at Boston University. Speaking was visiting scholar Harcourt Fuller. Mr. Fuller's lecture was titled Slavery and Abolition in Peru. We began with an introduction by Professor Linda Haywood, Director of Boston University's African American Studies Program. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Jim Kiesling. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotis. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.